Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, September 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the humanitarian crisis becomes even more dire in the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico.
This is the single major, biggest major catastrophe in the history of Puerto Rico, bar none.
The latest comments from President Trump on the NFL controversy. What are the leaks on the Russia investigation really coming from? Also ahead, a movie that, again, takes on the U.S. food industry. It's all on today's International Edition. Maria, the most powerful storm to hit Puerto Rico in nearly 90 years, caused widespread flooding and damage to homes and infrastructure. The U.S. territory is struggling with a lack of fuel, water, and medical supplies, and its entire energy grid was destroyed. Officials on the island are pressing the Trump administration to lift a prohibition on foreign ships delivering supplies from the U.S. mainland. President Trump's administration has so far not granted the request, but he did announce that he plans to visit the island on Tuesday. VOA's Zlatika Hulk has more on this growing crisis.
Puerto Rico was cut off from mainland U.S. for days after Hurricane Maria left the island without power, clean water, and communications. The island has run out of food, fuel, and medical supplies at a time when hospitals are more crowded than ever. Some people have waited at the San Juan airport since last week for a flight off the island, including this woman who depends on insulin injections.
They don't have no ice here. They don't have anything to help me keep my insulin safe.
President Trump on Tuesday hastened to address critics who said his administration has neglected the storm-hit U.S. territories.
We are unloading on an hourly basis massive loads of water and food and supplies for Puerto Rico.
The president also met with emergency officials on Tuesday, who later told reporters that flotillas with supplies and personnel were dispatched to the islands to deal with the increasing humanitarian crisis.
There are thousands of federal staff from FEMA, Department of Defense, and other federal agencies in Puerto Rico and in the U.S. Virgin Islands, supporting those governors in response and recovery.
Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rossella also spoke in Trump's defense as he toured a gas facility near San Juan Port. He said he had spoken with the president and was reassured that he cared about the island.
I am confident that he does, and I fully expect his support on this effort. He has verbally made that clear to me personally. So, you know, and again, I want to thank him for acting quickly on some of these things.
As Puerto Rico's ports and airports restore their capacity to receive more cargo ships and planes, the distribution of aid is expected to speed up. But Maria is not done yet. The storm is moving north along the U.S. coast, causing waves and flooding in North Carolina and forcing evacuations from some coastal areas. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Why Myanmar's government won't negotiate with the Rohingya insurgents. Trump administration is proposing to further cut refugee cap. The Ohio coroner says a U.S. student held in North Korea died of an oxygen-starved brain. And President Trump vows to pursue repeal of a health care law despite another setback. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, Western countries increasingly say Russia is making no secret of its efforts to meddle in or influence their affairs, including their elections. Yet they admit attempts to fend off those actions are having trouble gaining traction. Here in the United States, the investigation into Russian meddling into the 26th presidential election seems to be heating up, with reports that special counsel Robert Mueller plans to interview several current and high-level Trump aides. We also hear an Internal Revenue Service criminal division unit is cooperating. Joining me now to discuss all of it is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor of policy and government at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. So what do you make of these latest reports?
We don't know where the investigation is, and that is a tribute to the professionalism of the special prosecutor's office. The Trump White House leaks like a 57 Chevy. We find out about conversations a day or two after they happen about Trump outbursts and temper tantrums. It's very unusual in Washington for a presidency to be that badly run. But at the same time, it is also unusual for an office the size of Mueller's to maintain this kind of operational security. So you'll hear people say, oh, there's a trickle of information that suggests this and that suggests they're looking at that or they're looking, but no one really knows.
Are you saying that some of these things that we're hearing that's been from news organizations is not necessarily accurate?
No, I'm sure it's accurate. I'm sure somebody said it. I'm saying that the ultimate truth about what Mueller is about to do or where he's going or what is the thinking of his office is, I have seen very little that suggests anyone knows that except the people on his team. There was something that came out in the press 3-4 weeks ago that I think is not getting enough attention. Sources out of New York say that Mueller is working with the Attorney General of New York. And that is significant because it suggests that Mueller is afraid of a sweeping issuing of pardons, that Trump could issue pardons for Flynn, Manafort, Kushner, his sons, anybody, Carter Page, you know, everybody gets pardoned. And the pardon power is one of the only constitutional powers that is completely unchecked.
Well, why would working with the New York Attorney General change that?
Because if Trump has, or people close to Trump have, committed tax fraud under the state of New York laws, Trump's pardon doesn't extend to those crimes at all. President can't get you out of a parking ticket issued by a state, let alone a criminal prosecution. So that gives Mueller a very powerful additional weapon to use against Trump's inner circle. Because based on the journalism that David Fahrenthold did last year, I don't think there's anyone who studies this who thinks that a good case couldn't be made that Trump's guilty of some pretty serious charitable tax fraud.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he took money out of his charitable foundation and used it to pay a fine in Palm Springs. You cannot self-deal like that. You're using tax-free money for a business purpose.
Would that be part of the Russia investigation?
He has a very broad mandate.
A lot of people maybe don't understand the difference between laws involving the federal government and laws on the state level. You would think that the federal level would be more powerful. But what I'm hearing from you is that when it comes to these types of issues with presidential pardons and authority, that's where it digresses.
There is an open legal debate about whether a president can pardon himself. But Trump is uniquely ignorant and shameless, and he may well pardon 20 people and himself. And because of that, where the question of state law has come up in the Russia investigation, as it did not in previous presidential investigations, but Trump might well do it.
Some of these stories we've been hearing lately are that there is a very strong potential for indictments of several key Trump associates. Those are getting pretty close to the president himself. How likely do you think it is for the president himself to be in jeopardy of having some legal issues when this whole thing is said and done?
I think it's very likely that Donald Trump will face serious legal consequences, although there's another open question whether Mueller can actually indict a sitting president, and most people think he wouldn't do that. But you're right. It seems like Mueller is going after Flynn and Manafort more than anybody. And interestingly, he's also going after Flynn's son, and that's a classic organized crime move. You go after the son of somebody you want to flip because you might be brave and say, out of loyalty to Trump, I will accept punishment and not tell the truth and not reveal what I know. But if it's your son, and prosecutors can do things that look shady or somewhat slight, like pressuring someone by saying, hey, if you come to our side, we can work out that problem with your son. And what works on the mob is probably going to work on Flynn. It's just human nature. So if he can flip Flynn, if he can flip Manafort, then he can start to build a strong case on obstruction of justice and perhaps collusion of Russia. There is a third overarching point that I would make about Russia right now, and that is what happened with Facebook in the last 2 weeks. Facebook initially was denying any involvement in the 2016 outcome. Didn't happen, don't know what you're talking about. But now it turns out that hundreds of thousands of dollars in ads were purchased by people who were not Americans, which is probably a violation of campaign finance laws, and that they were designed to divide Americans And they were done so cleverly that it seems like you'd have to have somebody who knows American politics really well helping you out. It's not something that a Russian diplomat could do. It's not something that a Russian spy could do. These were really targeted. And the collusion smoke got a lot thicker these last couple weeks.
If you're saying that a president would be very difficult to indict, what difference would it make?
Oh, it makes a huge difference, because the point of a special prosecutor is not to put a criminal prosecution of the president through the courts. The point is to make a report to Congress and the public that will lead to impeachment. So what we're going to get out of Mueller is a lot of charges against a lot of people close to the president. And from their testimony, it is possible that a case of impeachment will be made by members of Congress. The real challenge is the polarized times that we live in. So evidence of collusion with one of America's mortal enemies emerges. I think it's an open question whether Republicans would impeach their president.
All right. Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at George Mason University. Thanks for your perspective. And turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. And Andrew, this Russian investigation continues to get a lot of attention, with social media platforms becoming part of the story, including fake ads paid for by the Russians that showed up on Facebook during the campaign.
Well, we're getting word now that some of those ads may have advocated for specific candidates, namely Jill Stein, who was the Green Party candidate running to the left, the political left of the Democrats, and even Bernie Sanders, who is Hillary Clinton's primary opponent during the primaries leading up to the general election. So this is the first instance we're hearing that these ads supported specific candidates, and I'm sure that's something that Congress is going to want to look into as the social networks and technology companies are asked to testify on Capitol Hill. And I have no doubt that they will be asked to testify. But as we're talking about all this Russian interference, we're also getting word from President Trump about Facebook. And he has some rather unkind words about Facebook. He says Facebook was always anti-Trump. The networks, referring to the television networks here in the United States, were always anti-Trump. And he alleges that there is collusion between Facebook and the TV networks. This is something new from President Trump. Of course, we've heard him say fake news and say that the media is lying. The first time now he's saying that Facebook is part of that. We'll see if this is maybe part of his effort to undercut Facebook or try to take attention off of the Russian ads. We're not sure what exactly this means, but this is the latest line from President Trump that Facebook is colluding against him and has always been anti-Trump.
All right. Well, we'll watch how this one unfolds.
Yes, and it surely will. Just one chapter in this unfolding saga.
Exactly. There are many, many more to come, I'm sure.
Oh,
so
yes.
What else is going on?
Well, we'll go to a happier story and a lighter story. You're used to the number 140 with regard to social media, because that is the number of characters that you use to send out a tweet on Twitter. Well, get ready for a new number, because Twitter is upping the character limit to 280 characters.
Really?
Yes. So they are rolling this out slowly. Not everybody has it right now. It's only select people, but they will be rolling this out. Hmm. Some question as to why they're doing this.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask why.
Yeah, some people are speculating that social media messages have gotten longer. We've seen a number of instances where people will have to use a number of tweets to tell a story or try to tell a narrative.
Isn't that the fun of tweeting?
That is part of the fun of tweeting, but maybe trying to make that a little less difficult. Other people speculate that Twitter has lost a lot of users and they're trying to gain them back. And by lengthening these messages, it might make it easier for people to tweet. But it's worth noting, this is not universal, because if you tweet in a language like Korean or Chinese or Japanese, a character-based language, your character count is staying at 140, because those languages tend to use less characters. If you use a language that's in the Latin alphabet, for instance, English, French, Spanish, Portuguese, you will go up to 280. It's not clear how they're going to be rolling this out or how quickly they're going to be rolling this out, but we've already seen tweets pop up that are 280 characters or up to 280 characters. It looks kind of weird in your Twitter feed to see these long messages.
Okay.
But I think before long, we're going to get used to it and see a lot more characters on Twitter.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, President Donald Trump said Tuesday he thinks it's disgraceful that the National Football League players are kneeling during the national anthem to protest racism in the country, and he called on the league to put a stop to it. Numerous team members issued statements in support of the players' cause, and on Wednesday, Trump told reporters that if the NFL doesn't change this, business is, quote, going to go to hell. Joining me now to discuss is Michael Ezra, professor of American Multicultural Studies at Sonoma State University in California. The president, Michael, says it's disrespectful to the flag and the country.
I think people should first look at what President Trump's motivation might be in randomly bringing up this issue during a rally. So I don't think this is really about patriotism or police brutality. It's more about the president, I think, attempting to co-opt the narrative and turn weaknesses such as Russia and North Korea into strengths. It's an attempt to distract and racially divide, and it has nothing to do with, like, coherence or logic.
You don't really believe he's just taking a stand for patriotism?
No, not in any way. I think it's completely 100% disingenuous.
What are the American people to take away from all of this? I mean, this is not going away, and yet we do have other issues that are very concerning to a lot of Americans, including what's happening in Puerto Rico, the devastation there from Hurricane Maria. We've got the threat of North Korea, which is very frightening to a lot of people. What can happen here to make this narrative shift to something that people would feel better about?
I think that people are using the Twitter feed of the president to make news. And so he really has taken control of a lot of the news cycle through the tweets. And I think people won't ignore them. But to make the president speak in more formal venues like press conferences and talk to reporters who ask him questions is probably the only way that the narrative surrounding the president will shift. I think what has basically happened is that we have a government that operates independently of the president at this point.
What about the issue of race? Because a lot of people are pointing to this as the president further escalating things that happened back in Charlottesville, brought up the tensions of racial disparity in a way that portrays himself as insensitive to that.
And he seems vulnerable to that in the sense that he actually clarified his comments to make it clear that he's not talking about race. I don't agree with that. I believe that race is the dog whistle, obviously, and race is at the heart of American politics. And the Republican Party, in a way it probably never thought it would have to, is now having to reconcile with this issue that not all Republicans are racist, but the Republican Party gets 91% of its votes from whites. It has never been able to penetrate the consciousness and loyalty of mass numbers of non-white people. And there's a reason for it. Its policies speak more to whites and disproportionately hurt non-whites. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's every politician's racist intent, but that has happened and voters have spoken accordingly. And now you take a president who doesn't have the political savvy to code that message in larger ideas of uplift that helps everybody, and you have a party's flaw, its deadly flaw, exposed.
Why do you think more Republicans aren't speaking out?
People are afraid. The president can use Twitter to isolate a lone congressperson or Senate and get millions of people to reconsider their vote and also drown that person's message in the fight with the president. The president can talk about how the flag protests are about the military, then he can switch and say it's about race, then he can switch and say it's about police brutality, and people's heads are spinning, and they're following these tweets that come out every 60 minutes and taking them as logical and coherent policy statements instead of someone's personal attempt to get something off their mind. I mean, the use of social media is for friends to discuss stuff. It's not for coherent policy discussion.
All right. Thank you for your opinions. Michael Ezra, professor at Sonoma State University. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world, and you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues. The Washington Wizards of the National Basketball Association are getting ready to hit the basketball courts for another NBA season. VOA's Salem Solomon reports they're part of a league-wide trend that sees more and more international players making their mark on the game of basketball.
More than ever, basketball is becoming a global game. Last season, the NBA had 113 international players from 41 countries and territories. In all, one quarter of NBA players are international. The Washington Wizards alone have players from Poland and the Czech Republic, in addition to two players with roots in Africa. Ian Mahinmi, a 2.1-meter center for France, represents this diversity. His mother's from Jamaica and his father's from the West African nation of Benin. Mahinmi told VOA he grew up wanting to play soccer, but as he kept growing, he realized his future was on the hardwood.
I really wanted to be a soccer player, and then I grew so tall, and eventually I gave a shot to a basketball and then fell in love with it, and the next thing you know, I'm here.
As he enters his 10th season in the NBA, he sees the game is growing.
Now it's not only soccer now. You know, basketball definitely took a big part in people's heart. You know, I feel like it's more and more young folks that grow up to be basketball player. It's more and more African players in the NBA. So it's been a big growth, you know, since I got in the league.
The NBA now holds an annual exhibition game on the continent and has opened a youth academy in Senegal. Mahinmi, too, is doing his part, traveling to Benin last summer to teach basketball fundamentals to young players.
It was unreal, you know. The love that they showed me and the welcoming from the minute we got out the plane till the last minute was tremendous. You know, this was probably like the trip of the summer for me and my dad, probably the trip of our life. So, you know, it's something that we want to do every summer.
Wizards head coach Scott Brooks says that as the NBA looks to expand globally, Africa is a big part of its future.
Well, I think the entire continent. I think it's so important for us to continue to build our brand as an NBA. And I think Africa is definitely something that we've been considering for a long time. But Adam Silver and the NBA office has done a great job of making basketball a worldwide global game, and Africa is a big part of that.
For now, the Wizards' attention is focused on the upcoming NBA season, which starts off on October 18th. Last year, they won 49 games and nearly reached the Eastern Conference Finals. This year, they're hoping to do better. Solomon Solomon for VOA News, Washington, D.C.
Well, documentarian Morgan Spurlock is taking on the food industry again. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, Super Size Me 2, Holy Chicken, has Spurlock opening his own fast food restaurant.
13 years ago, Morgan Spurlock took on McDonald's restaurants in his groundbreaking Super Size Me, where he ate nothing but McDonald's food for a month and showed audiences the health consequences of that diet. Now Spurlock is taking on the food industry in a different way, from the inside. In Super Size Me 2, Holy Chicken, the documentarian opens his own fast food chicken place. When the film premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, Spurlock said he wanted to tell a very different story from his first film.
The first film was almost from a consumer point of view, like the choices we make, what we buy, what we eat. This one is from the industry perspective. Like, what is it, how do I manipulate you as a consumer? How do I raise the food or sell it to you in a certain way? And I think that it shows a very different side of the fast food industry, and one that I think is going to be really enlightening to people.
Morgan Spurlock says that one of his aims with this film was to expose the so-called greenwashing in the food industry, where public relations and marketing are deceptively used to promote the perception that an organization's products, aims, or policies are environmentally friendly.
Well, there's so much like of this greenwashing that's happened since the first film came out, where we all believe like things are getting better, things are getting healthier for us. You know, there's healthier options, and what you start to realize is how much of that is just manipulation, corporate manipulation of us as consumers. Like, we want to believe so badly that somebody's looking out for you and me, but the fact is nobody's looking out for you and me.
Spurlock directed and co-wrote the film with Jeremy Chilnick, who worked with Spurlock on several other projects, including Palm Wonderful, the greatest movie ever sold. In Toronto, Spurlock said that he chose the chicken fast food industry because more chickens are eaten every year than any other animal.
And I think what we hope with this film, first film did a great job of kind of really changing consumer behavior, making us look at the choices we made in a different way. And the reason we picked McDonald's in that first film was because McDonald's was the biggest. They're the biggest fast food chain in the world, fed more people on a global scale. And if we could somehow kind of poke that bully with a stick, something may change. This is a very similar animal in that we chose, no pun intended, the chicken because it's the most eaten animal on the planet. Like 20 billion chickens are eaten every year. So if we can somehow kind of chip away at that, we could have a ripple effect in the whole industry.
The film explores many facets of the chicken industry, some of which viewers could find disturbing, including the way that the birds are raised and slaughtered. Spurlock also seeks to inform viewers about the way the industry is run, how only a few food companies control all the chicken that we eat. As in his previous film, Morgan Spurlock uses a mix of serious exposé and humor that could help the medicine he is trying to give audiences go down a little easier. Super Size Me 2 Holy Chicken will be released theatrically in 2018 before making its exclusive global premiere on YouTube Red. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump issued new travel restrictions on nationals of North Korea, Venezuela, and Chad, while continuing to restrict the travel of citizens from five of the six countries included in Executive Order 13780. The new restrictions will take effect on October 18th for nationals of North Korea, Venezuela, and Chad. The government of North Korea does not cooperate with the United States in any respect and fails to satisfy all information-sharing requirements. Therefore, entry into the United States of nationals of North Korea as immigrants and non-immigrants is suspended. The government in Venezuela is uncooperative in verifying whether its citizens pose national security or public safety threats, fails to share public safety and terrorism-related information adequately, and has been assessed to be not fully cooperative with respect to receiving its nationals subject to final orders of removal from the United States. Accordingly, the entry into the United States of certain Venezuelan government officials and their immediate family members as non-immigrants on business, tourist, and business tourist visas is suspended. Chad, President Trump noted, was added to the list despite its government being an important counterterrorism partner because its government is not able at this time to adequately share public safety and terrorism-related information. Accordingly, the entry into the United States of nationals of Chad as immigrants and as non-immigrants on business, tourist, and business tourist visas is suspended. Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, and Somalia were left on the list of affected countries in the new proclamation issued by the president. But restrictions on citizens from Sudan were lifted. Iraqi citizens will not be subject to travel prohibitions because of the close cooperative relationship between the United States and the democratically elected government of Iraq. Citing security, President Trump made clear his reasons for issuing the new travel restrictions in a tweet. "Making America safe is my number one priority. We will not admit those into our country we cannot safely vet."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.